sure whether it was the wheat versus weeds, good versus evil, night versus day, master versus enemy in the parable in Matthew. Or it was Israel versus Hamas, ISIS versus Iraq, Sunni versus Shia, Ukraine versus Russia, refugees versus citizens on the nightly news. It set me in search of the origins of us versus them thinking this week. Human life is an emotional roller coaster. Said an article that promised to transcend this us versus them thinking called binary thinking. And because life is an emotional roller coaster, when confronting emotionally charged events, individuals and groups and larger communities instinctively frame their predicament in a binary way, as polarities encompassing a dimension of choice with two mutually exclusive alternatives. Us or them. The physiology of this instinctive framing is breathtaking. Any stimulus from the outside enters our central nervous system and is immediately relayed in two directions. One pathway makes the information available to our cerebral cortex, which mediates cognitive, logical processing and precise recognition, thinking. A second pathway carries information toward the amygdala, a tiny but crucial subcortical structure, mediating an emotional reaction to the subject under scrutiny. The cortex and the amygdala receive this information at just about the same time. However, the amygdala decides whether we like the object or not. Like, and often initiates a behavioral response before the cortex has even managed to figure out what the object actually is. And long before we are allowed the luxury of conscious thought or conscious feeling, we instinctively react to outside stimuli from the amygdala, a part of the brain that is genetically designed to alert us to good versus evil, friend versus enemy, right versus wrong, and so on and so forth. This is literally our survival instinct. So, in addition to that, according to another philosopher, whose name I can't really pronounce, whenever there are polar oppositions to things, right, wrong, light, dark, moon, sun, one of them is dominant. And of course, looking behind these pairs is usually gender, male, female. According to this critique, binary thinking almost always builds in dominance or privilege. One is better than the other. Sometimes overtly, sometimes covertly. According to neurobiologists, I think, even and especially before we acquire language, this binary response to the world around us settles into our psyches. So babes in arms, before they can even speak, learn to oppose being little. We're so big. Yay! childhood tendency toward dualism. There are now finer distinctions to be made. Birdies become robins and crows. Trees become maples and willows. Fishies become whales and trout. Yet what words do we use when differentiating among other human beings who come toward us and to whom we instinctually respond as friend or foe? Here where being human approaches its potential, our minds and our words often fail us. On one hand, our language cannot contain the reasons we love or feel kinship or are drawn to certain people. On the other, we balk at sorting out the complex nature of good and bad, right and wrong, kind and mean, life-giving and death-dealing, posed to us in an oppositional person or group, in somebody who seems to come after us, and there's something in us that says, oh, this is not good. Faced with the enigma of another, especially if we're feeling kind of vulnerable, we quit complexity in favor of binary thinking that reduces complicated peoples or persons to our evil opposite. No doubt, real politic can and sometimes must transform the most differentiated of thinkers into binary apologists for their nation or their people and the actions of nations and people during times of war. Yet when the binary thinking needed for survival in either-or conflicts continues long after survival is an issue, then hatred, often in the name of religion, takes hold of our hearts and turns them to stone. To repeat Paul's question of last week, who will deliver us from this body of death? Death all around us this week. Many philosophers cite something that most of us studied at some point in college or even high school. It's Hegel's dialectic. That's about all I understand about it. But it's the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And so some people think, that's a way to disarm our binary thinking. We may think thesis, antithesis, but then we seek synthesis. The problem is that presumes, again, this conflictual situation. A retired English professor named Peter Elbow suggests a kinder and gentler possibility that he calls dialogic both and. Dialogue both and. Not either or. And his thinking follows one of my favorite fellows whom I also do not understand, whose name is Niels Bohr, that particle physicist guy who had the complementary theory and the uncertainty theory and all those theories that are just beyond our heads, but somehow say something true. And so Niels Bohr, who looked at things from the way inside out, said the opposite of a correct statement is a false statement. But the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth. And Elbow goes on to say, even two or three or four or five profound truths. Central to the intellectual process, he says, or I would say central to the project of becoming human, is the ability to try on, to enter into, say what's right, what's wrong. Just hang on to it. Live into it. Because somehow holding these two opposite things together tells the truth in a way that we could never get to the truth unless we just held on for a while. Now it seems to me we are ready to consider what Jesus was up to when he told this parable. This parable presents a very familiar word. You start listening to parable, and you always go, oh, I know that. It's like, you know, the laborers are coming at the beginning of the day, and they're, you know, wage figured out, and you're thinking, yep. And then suddenly, at some point, the tables are turned on you. But this parable presents a familiar word that is ordered by binary thinking. Good versus evil, wheat versus tares, day versus night, master versus enemy. And in the world of this parable, this order is presumed rather than overturned, as it is in parables where the last become first and the first become last. Binary holds all the way through. From the outset, we need someone who sows good seed in this land. But when it is dark and everyone is asleep, except us, the storyteller lets us in on the fact that an enemy enters the land and sows weeds among the wheat, and then disappears. For the next few months, if you think of a growing season, everyone in the parable goes about business as usual, oblivious to the evil in their midst, until the wheat begins to come up and sprout. Only then do the slaves notice the weeds. And these are not just any weeds, they are tares. You know, wheat and tares together sown. And tares, the real name for tares in Palestine, Israel, they still grow. They're called bearded darnels. A clever detail lost on us. Here is the most mind-blowing thing about this parable. As one commentator put it, the bearded darnel is the devil of a weed. Its roots surround the roots of the plants, sucking up precious nutrients and scarce water, making it impossible to root it out without damaging the good crop. Above ground, the darnel looks identical to wheat until it bears seed. When grain appears, wheat bows its head. But darnel continues to grow straight toward the heavens defiantly. In addition, the seeds of the darnel can be hallucinogens or can cause death. So the appearance of the darnel caused the slaves question the good intentions of the master. Had he not sown good seed, they ask? And if so, where did the weeds come from? In exemplary binary fashion, the owner tells them, an enemy did this. What we know from the beginning, and I wonder if the sower knew it too, finally has been revealed to the workers in the field. Unlike the previous parable from last week, where seeds fell by chance on path or rocky ground or among thorns, here is a field full of good seed, and it is intentionally invaded by an enemy who nefariously sows weeds by night. In every way, the binary world of good and bad, evil and good, is starkly drawn. Well, you can almost see the amygdala of the slaves light up once they understand the situation. They have been placed in a field where wheat is being overtaken by weeds, where good is being choked by evil, where their master is being sabotaged by an enemy. Thus, we miss the truth that we can only know through the world of the parable. The master in the parable orders the slaves to do nothing in the face of the presence of evil. He tells them this because in the time between the growing season and the harvest, there's no way to pull up the weeds without also killing the wheat. The image kind of suggests an intimacy between good and evil. And then given the difficulty of distinguishing between wheat and bearded darnel, it asserts our inability to tell one from the other in the time between. Therefore, the master instructs the slaves to let the wheat and tares grow together until the harvest, when the problem of good and evil will not be in their hands, but in the hands of reapers whose proper job it is to separate wheat from weeds, good from evil, life from death. As the world of the parable holds in solution the paradox of good and evil growing together, both we and the characters are invited to pause, to take a deep breath, not to act on our binary instincts. As always, my mind races to objections about opposing Hitler and Stalin and Boko Haram and Hamas, and right now Vladimir Putin. Yet I think this parable addresses a more intimate intertwining of good and evil in the fields where we labor, the homes and streets where we live. The counsel is to pause, to wait and watch, to trust the knowing of good and evil to God, because we were made from the beginning not to know that, but to know God alone. God knows this goes against our instinct, the same instincts that found us crucifying the parable of God, killing the one in whom the opposition of God and sinners was held together, and without our doing, has come to an end. Presently, I think the only character pausing is God. Having assumed and redeemed the good and evil intertwined in each of us, God is letting time play out, watching as wheat and tares grow together unawares, weeping as slaves to binary thinking preempt God's judgment on the borders between good and evil, laughing as the church seeks moral purity through division rather than multiplication. It was this parable that prompted Augustine to call